Hello, listeners. A Party Podcast is more than just a podcast. It's a platform where academia meets real-world narratives, where rigid policy frameworks are juxtaposed against human experience. Here, we don't just dissect global issues. We humanize them, we narrate them, and we invite you to join us in reimagining a world where policy is not just about governance, but about understanding and nurturing the human spirit that drives the essence of global interactions. We are a podcast founded within the Boston University Party School of Global Affairs community. Feel free to explore the Party Atlas page to check out other graduate student content at Boston University. All right. Welcome back to the third episode of the Party Podcast. Today, we will be having our guest, Major Jaytuan Millage of the U.S. Army, to talk about his role as a foreign area officer currently stationed in Senegal. So it'll be a really interesting interview to gain a lot of his insights. But before we get to that, I would like to introduce my new co-host, Claire. So Claire, if you want to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, why you're interested in joining the podcast, and kind of your interest in international relations.
Of course. Hi, everyone. My name is Claire Budin. I am a second year MAIA student along with Carl, and I'm specializing in diplomacy. And I wanted to join the podcast, not only because I just love talking about this topic, of course. I loved the tagline of the podcast, which is to humanize issues of global policy and development. I think it's really important that we move away from, I guess, academizing everything and, you know, remind ourselves through this that there's a human face to everything we do. So, and I love seeing our alumni do amazing things as well.
Excited for our first episode together, and especially that we have one of our former classmates, Major Jaytuan Millage. It's great to have you here.
Hey, folks, thanks for having me. You know, Major Jaytuan Millage sounds so official. While I appreciate the respect, feel free to call me Jay for the rest of the interview, because I know you want to anyways, so go for it. But again, yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for agreeing to do this. So kind of just to start, can you kind of talk about your role as a foreign area officer? How did you get into that role? What led to your interest?
Yeah. Hey, Carl, thank you for the question. So I'll split this up into two ways, because I think a lot of your listeners are probably just going to be wondering, what is a foreign area officer? So I'll kind of break it down into two separate portions. So first and foremost, like any other United States military officer in 2012, I signed the dotted line. Sometimes I'm not actually sure why I did it, but I did, right? And so from 2012 to about 2022, I served as a, about 2021 actually, I served as a field artillery officer in the United States Army. One of the last assignments that I had as a field artillery officer was SFAB. What SFAB stands for is Security Force Assistance Brigade. What the SFAB does is we in small man teams or small person teams, right? I guess that's a better way of saying it. We go out to different countries, depending on the region that we're associated with, and we train host nation militaries on conventional type warfare things. In the process of doing that, I learned that within the U.S. embassies, there's a such thing called a security cooperation office, which I'll talk about that a little later. But what a security cooperation? There is a security cooperation office, and the people that work there are called foreign area officers. And of course, I was extremely intrigued by that because they weren't wearing a uniform. They were wearing civilian clothes like I'm wearing right now. And I was like, that's fantastic. I want to wear civilian clothes and still be in the military. So I said, hey, sign me up. How do I sign up? And so I figured out how to sign up. I went and learned French, which is my we call it a control language. French is my control language. Donc, je parle français bien. I learned my language. And then, of course, I went to grad school and met you beautiful people there at Boston University. And then, you know, here I am out in a beautiful, beautiful Dakar, Senegal, enjoying and soaking up the sun out here. So that was kind of the way I did it. Now, as far as what a foreign area officer is, right, and I kind of alluded to it a little bit, we kind of work in security cooperation. What is security cooperation, right? Security cooperation is this, it's really just this umbrella term that we use within the U.S. government between the Department of Defense and the Department of State to describe how we interact with host nation militaries on the U.S. side, right? It's that military-to-military cooperation. that's how we describe it. We call it security cooperation. And within that is a whole host of things, right? There's training that occurs. There's military exercises that occur. All of that gets housed out of the security cooperation office within that embassy, within that country. FAOs head that up. And so that's kind of what we do. That's kind of our bread and butter. That's number one. The second part of that is we become experts in our region, right? So for me, I'm a 48 Juliet, which is the designation that the United States Army gives me, which is a sub-Saharan Africa foreign area officer. That means that in 20 years, when I'm a lot smarter than I am right now, I'm going to be an expert on all things on the African continent, right? Which is not true. It'll never happen. But that's the goal. And the goal is that I take that expertise and I go back to the Pentagon or go back to DC, and I'm able to, you know, as they're trying to make decisions on military policy in, let's say, Senegal or Ghana or Burundi or Rwanda, they call on us as experts, right? To be like, hey, well, you've been to that country, you served in that country in a military way. What do you suggest? So that's kind of the overarching theme of what a foreign area officer is.
Perfect. So in your view, what are the key security challenges facing Senegal right now and also other African nations today? And how is the U.S. military working to address those challenges? And how does that kind of fit in with your role?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Claire. So the, you know, as I said earlier, you know, the security cooperation is in charge of that military to military cooperation, right? And so anything that we're going to do from a military perspective within that country to help aid that country is going to come out of the Security Cooperation Office, right? So let me dissect your question, right? So let's talk about security concerns first. You know, on the continent, you know, my take, you know, I think a lot of people will be surprised if they find out that there are U.S. military personnel working within some of these countries. The first question people would ask is why? Why are we there? Why do we have a presence, right? And I always correct people because presence is not the right word. We're not there in a presence standpoint. We're there in a cooperation standpoint, right? We're there to engage in a cooperative point of view with the host nation military. So anyways, with that being said, I think it's important to understand that physical security, border security is the basis for everything, right? If you don't have border or physical security, everything else falls apart. You don't have economic security. You don't have food security. You don't have political security. That's why we exist, right? That's why the Security Cooperation Office exists, is to help that host nation provide border and physical security for their country. Now, to backtrack, right? So within Senegal, there are really two main you know, security threats that I would say. There are more, but these are the two that I kind of think of the most. Border security is number one, right? You know, the country shares a border with a couple other countries, which actually the Gambia, I don't know if you've looked at a map of Senegal, but the Gambia actually sits right inside Senegal, kind of like a Pac-Man situation. Now, the countries themselves are fine, but there's obviously, just like any other country, right? There's a criminal element that does things around those borders because borders are porous, right? It's hard to patrol an entire country border. So I think the first concern is the criminal element that exists on some of those borders that both countries, you know, that share that border work to get rid of. But that is an existential threat for Senegal. That's number one in my mind. Number two, and so just like two-thirds of Africa, right, Senegal has a land border and a sea border, right? And so the other threat comes from there. Senegal has one of the most professional navies on the western coast of Africa, just a really well-trained professional navy. And for the most part, they patrol from Senegal all the way down to the Guinea coast, right, all the way kind of down the western seaboard there. Very, very professional navy. One of the biggest threats that we see on the seaboard side is IUU fishing, right? IUU fishing stands for illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, right? What that means is unflagged vessels illegally come into Senegalese or other West African nation ocean space, water space, and they fish illegally. Now, why is that a problem, right? Well, it's a problem for a couple of different reasons. It's an economic issue, for one, right? You know, there's these people that fish in these countries, that's their livelihood, right? It's how they make money for their family. It's how they feed their family. It's how they feed people in the country, right? And so when you have people illegally fishing, it's taking from that, right? Number one. Number two, on another economic standpoint, you know, a lot of Senegal is fishing industry. So again, if other countries are illegally flagged vessels are coming in and taking the fish that exists there, again, that's hurting economically, not only the country now, but the fishermen themselves. The third issue is the ecosystem. And this is the one that people think about the least. if you know, professional countries that have a professional fishing industry like Senegal, they very much take into consideration how much fish they're fishing per year. That's a very responsible thing to do when you're talking about the fishing ecosystem, right? Well, when you have illegally unflagged vessels coming in and just taking fish, that means they're not taking into consideration the reproduction rate of those fish. So that's how you have fish go extinct. So you have this issue with ecosystem where people, you know, fish that used to exist 10 years ago don't exist anymore because overfishing, right, is a thing. So I would think, again, on the border side, I think it's that criminal element that exists on the border, you know, from benign or malignant actors. And then on the seaside, I would say is the IUU fishing.
Yeah. And I'm really, the point about fishing is really interesting. And I think it's important to bring up that I think oftentimes people's view of what the responsibility military has can be very limited, but that shows that it bleeds into a lot of aspects of the society that you're cooperating with.
Yeah, absolutely. That's important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just to go back to your original question, right? And so we know that, right? So within the Security Cooperation Office, we do a lot of work to make sure that, you know, I think sometimes people get this idea that the U.S. goes into these countries and we say, hey, we don't really care what you need. We're going to give you what we think. Not true at all, right? We take pride within the Security Cooperation Office. We really, really listen to the partner and we say, hey, what is it that you need? What is it that you need? What is it that you want from us? What is it that's going to make your country a more safe and habitable place to live for your citizens? So we really do listen, right? We take pride in listening. So that's important.
What are some of the most rewarding aspects of your job?
It's all of it. It really is all of it, Carl. One, there's a personal connection for me, right? Obviously, I'm African American. Of course, I'm American first, and I'm proud of that fact. But at some point in my family line, just based off the way I look and the way my hair looks, somebody from my family came from Africa, right? Somebody in my family came from Africa, so that's a good thing, and so it's personal for me in that regard. Outside of that, though, I mean, if you really think about this continent, I'll tell you what. I was interviewing for another job, right? So I'm going to Burundi next. I'm going to work as the Office of Security Cooperation Chief in Burundi next. And when I was interviewing for the job, he was like, where do you want to go? Why do you want to go to Burundi? I said, hey, sir, I'll tell you what. I said, you can send me anywhere you want to, but I want to do the most amount of good for the most amount of people, right? That's my goal. That's my goal in life. I want to do the most amount of good for the most amount of people. And that's why I love being here, right? Because you can truly do that. Outside of that, the cultures are amazing. The people are amazing. You know, if you think about the history of Africa, right? I can't think of any other region of the world that has been accosted as much as the region of Africa, right? You had four different slave trades almost going on simultaneously on the East Coast, on the West Coast with the Atlantic slave trade, and North and in the central part of Africa, right? Almost four different slave trades going on almost simultaneously. And then after that, oh, we're almost done with you. Then we got colonization, right? Some was good, some was not so good. Well, none of it was good, quite frankly, but you know what I mean by that. And then after all of that, right, all these African nations started to get independence in the late 50s, early 60s. And then there was this neocolonialism, right? Like, hey, I know we released you, but we didn't really release you, right? We're still going to keep control of you somehow, which I have opinions on that I won't talk about in this official capacity. But outside of all of that, I mean, with all of that, the atrocities that have been committed on nations in this continent, they are some of the most beautiful, positive, resilient, welcoming, hospitable. This is the only time you'll hear me generalize Africa as a continent. Every place I've been to, they are the most hospitable, resilient, beautiful, welcoming people you'll ever meet. You come here, and if you want to be here, and if you understand, or I'm sorry, not even understand, if you are willing to understand the cultures, they'll open up welcome you with open arms, and they'll love you, and they'll feed you. I've been invited to more dinners and had more local food than even in the U.S. I can't even get another U.S. citizen to invite me into their house to have dinner. I've been invited to more here than I can count, right? I love it here. I really do love it here. I know that went way beyond your question, but I have to say it.
No, I mean, that's an excellent answer. And, you know, I think that this is important, especially for those of us who haven't had the opportunity to travel to Africa to kind of get a better understanding. Because, you know, the news doesn't always do a great job of portraying all the positive aspects of things going on in different regions of the world. So it's, you know, and especially, you know, as a podcast that likes to focus on the more personal, the personal side and getting away from, you know, the news and the academic jargon, you know, hearing about your experiences is very valuable. So just to kind of follow up on that, you mentioned, this was kind of a question I was going to save until the end, but you, you mentioned moving forwards, what you're going to be doing. I was just wondering kind of what your next steps are going to look like. What position are you going to be in, if you're able to talk about that and kind of how that differs from what you're doing now?
So as a part of becoming a foreign area officer, we go through three phases, right? The first phase is language. So I got hammered with French for 9 months, and it was fantastic. And then I went to grad school and met, you know, you beautiful folks. The third phase of the training to become a foreign area officer is what we call in-region training, right? You come to the continent, you get posted at an embassy. So I'm posted at Dakar, Senegal. But really my job is to travel the continent and learn about the different cultures, learn about the different languages, learn about the religions, and learn about the military aspects. My next assignment, I'm going to, like I said earlier, I'm heading off to Burundi. In Burundi, I'll be the Office of Security Cooperation Chief. So within U.S. embassies, the chief is the head of that section, right? So I'll be the head of the Security Cooperation section at U.S. Embassy Bujumbura in Burundi. I got to say this too, because now I'm just excited to talk about it. People, here's another misconception. People get this idea that for some reason, I think it's because of TV and movies, Carl. I think you said it earlier. People get this misconception that people that live in Africa are not educated. I don't know where this misconception came from. At the least, no matter what country you go to on this continent, everybody knows at least three languages. Mm-hmm. At least. Most of them know more. Mm-hmm. So in Burundi, the average person knows English. They know Swahili. They know Kirundi, the language of Burundi. They know Kinyarwanda, which is the language of Rwanda, and they also know French. Five languages. The average person, I'm not talking about scholars, I'm talking about the average person on the street, knows five languages. So I don't know where this misconception comes from. But anyways, I've been trying to teach myself Kirundi, which is the local language in Burundi. I think language is important. Some of my counterparts don't believe in it as much as I do. But I think I hate being in Senegal and speaking French, because that's not their language. Their local language is called Wolof. I wish I could learn Wolof. It's a very difficult language to learn. But I feel like if I'm going to really understand the people and really care about the people and really care about their culture, then at the very least, I should learn their language. That's very, very important to me.
I'm going to be going back to Senegal for just a second and discussing, in that sort of vein of cooperation, if you could discuss a specific instance where your work as FAO directly contributed to strengthening bilateral or multilateral relations between the U.S. and Senegal, and or regional organizations as well, or even organizations maybe outside Senegal, but still in the region.
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic question. And I'm going to answer for Senegal, and I'm going to answer for another country. So for Senegal specifically, yeah, I do it every day, right? I mean, so for example, right, because you wanted an example. Yes, that's great. Within the realm of security cooperation, there are a couple things that we do, right? There's IMET, which is military education training, international military education training. There's invitational conferences and things like that. And there's also exercises, right? So what are exercises, right? So exercises are these multi-nation military exercises that I hate using the definition of, but anyways, these multi-nation military level exercises that take place. And there are land exercises. There are also sea exercises. So I've done it a couple times, but most recently, so there's a on the western side of Africa, so on my side of Africa, there's a exercise that goes on that's hosted by NAVAF. What is NAVAF? NAVAF is U.S. Naval Forces Africa, and they're stationed up in Naples, Italy. So this exercise is hosted by NAVAF. Cutlass Express. Actually, this is really good. This is really good because this really feeds back into Senegal and how great Senegal is. Cutlass Express is actually an exercise, a sea exercise that happens on the east coast of Africa, so not my side of Africa, right? It's put on by NAVAF. It's a multi-nation exercise, right? So you have the Kenyans are involved, the Tanzanians are involved, individuals from Mauritius are involved, Seychelles are involved, Malagasy from Madagascar are involved, mm-hmm. Comoros individuals, you know, people from Comoros are involved. I mean, just this massive maritime exercise that happens. And there's also one that happens on the West Coast. This is for the East Coast. So most recently, like, I actually traveled down. So in preparation for these exercises, we do these conferences, right? We do three of them, these planning conferences in preparation for the exercise. So one of the planning conferences was down in Lesotho. And so I escorted some of my fellow Senegalese military partners down to Lesotho for this this planning exercise. And it was great because number one, we got to sit in a room with individuals from other nations. And remember what I talked about earlier, right? IUU fishing, not only is it a problem on the western side of the continent, it's an even bigger problem on the eastern side of the continent. I'm not going to say why, but it is. This maritime exercise is extremely important for them because it's giving them the training tactics and techniques to be able to combat this IUU fishing, right? Which is a big thing. Anyways, so we go down to Lesotho. We're sitting in this room with other African partner nations there, and we're talking and we're planning this exercise. And it's just a great event, and it really mattered for me right now. Where does Senegal come in, right? So of course Senegal was there. But then you ask yourself, Claire, well, wait a minute. I thought you just said that Cutlass Express was an Eastern African maritime exercise. What in the world were Senegalese doing there? I'm going to tell you, right? Like I said before, the Senegalese Navy is one of the most professional navies I've ever ran to. They're so professional that U.S. Naval Forces Africa said, hey, Senegal, you are great at VBSS, which is vessel boarding and seizure operations. You are great at patrolling your borders. We want you to send your experts from Senegal to Djibouti to help train other African nations on things that you're an expert at. That's how fantastic Senegal is. And I had a part in that, and it was the most rewarding thing I'd ever done.
Absolutely. That's wonderful.
Yeah, which kind of makes me think of a sort of similar but slightly unrelated question. So from the way you've described Senegal, especially their military and their navy, it seems like African nations, particularly Senegal, are very conscious or very willing to kind of assert their agency, not only on their own continent, but we can see it in international institutions. So how do we support African nations in increasing their own agency, but also do it in a way that benefits the United States?
So I think, you know, to jump to the last part of your question first, because I think it's the more important part. I think no matter what you do, it will help the U.S. And the reason why I say it is because, you know, and again, I'm biased, right? Because I work and live and breathe and thrive on the continent of Africa. I think within the next 10 to 12 years, Africa is going to become one of the most important places in the world. And quite frankly, I think it already is, really. Mm-hmm. And so I think any time and devotion that we give to the countries on the continent is definitely an investment on returns. And I think the U.S. government understands that. Now, how can we help? How do we continue to support that? If I could sum that up into one word, I would say cooperation is that word. It is the continual cooperation with African nations, making sure that we're giving them what they need or asking them what they need and helping them in that regard. We haven't really brought up the terrorism thing yet. And so let me talk about it a little bit. In history, or historically speaking, geopolitically speaking, what happens when a country completely goes into chaos, right? Which it doesn't happen often, but what happens when it does? It's a rhetorical question. The answer is it becomes a hotbed for criminal elements, right? If your country has gotten to a point where there is no political rule, or the political rule is chaotic, or whatever it may be, if there's no border security or physical security, your country then becomes a hotbed for terrorist organization groups, right? We don't want that. We don't want that. And so the more attention that not only the United States, but other global actors pay on the continent of Africa will prevent things like that from happening, right? We don't want to see that happen on the continent, which is why we have, why within the Security Cooperation Office of all the countries on the continent, that's why we work so hard to make sure that they have, because in reality, there are things going on the continent right now, you know, terrorist threat type situations that are actively going on the continent. And we don't want to see that take hold. And so that's why I say Africa is one of the most important places.
If it isn't already, for Africa to be the most important continent when it comes to global affairs. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that and maybe discuss, as this importance grows, how you kind of see U.S. Collaboration, cooperation shifting along with that. And what do you think the U.S. needs to do more in terms of that collaboration?
Sure. So I heard three questions there. Mm-hmm. The first one being, you know, what do I mean by the most important place, if not already, right? Number one is there's just, you know, culturally, one of the most culturally diverse places I've been to. 54 countries with 54 different leaders, 54 different cultures, 54 different initiatives and priorities, right? And I think that becomes important on an international stage, right? Because if you have 54 different countries on one continent, but they all think differently and do different things, and you start to see, like BRICS, for example, right? You start to see things like BRICS pop up where you know, certain African nations are not on board with other things that other African nations are. I think that's important, right? I think that's what makes Africa so important, because there is so much to be had here, and there's so much to be done here, that there are so many international players here, right? Because they understand the importance of the continent. That's number one. Number two is just from a security standpoint. Again, if we can devote our efforts to making sure that the governments and the countries within this continent stay stable, both politically and economically, we can help stamp out whatever organizing of any terrorist groups, right? That's our goal, right? We want to stamp that out as much as possible, right? And helping to maintain that stability within these countries is the best way to do it, right? You know, that goes along with that. The other thing that makes Africa so important, and I hate saying this, right? Because I feel like a colonialist when I say it, but it's the resources, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, I think I read a statistic the other day, like 80% of the world's resources are within this continent, or like 7% or some crazy astronomical number, right? Now, why is that important, right? I think that's important for two different reasons. One, I think it's important because obviously as we start to move towards a more sustainable energy infrastructure, you obviously look to the producers of lithium and the producers of cobalt, which are here on the continent, right? The other thing is, I think that gives a lot of these African nations an opportunity to really, if they, you know, make these deals correctly, it gives them an opportunity to really change the dynamic of their economic status tenfold, right? Because again, you know, we haven't really cared about sustainable energy for the past 20 years, and now all of a sudden we do. And that's only going to grow in the next 10 years. Again, why I say it's one of the most important places in the world right now, because that interest in sustainable energy is going to continue to grow. All the resources are right here, baby. They're all right here. Mm-hmm. So it's going to take international cooperation. It's going to take nations within Africa understanding their value, mm-hmm. and maintaining their value and making sure that they're not being taken advantage of, right? Like we've seen in previous, for example, Sierra Leone with diamonds, right? Which is a horrible situation. There's that. So and finally, you know, do I think that us as a country or the U.S. needs to do more? Yes and no, right? I think we do a lot more than people realize. Here on the continent of Africa, that's number one. Could we do more? Absolutely. Should we do more? Yes. And do I think we're headed to that? Yes. Right now, our focus is elsewhere, just because of the current global threats, or what we perceive as threats. But I think very quickly that shift is going to start to turn towards Africa, especially as other international players start to get involved. I think it's going to become almost a requirement for the U.S. government to kind of get more involved than they already are.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is also, Africa is one of the focuses of my thesis. And, you know, it has 30% of the world's mineral reserves, 8% of natural gas, 12% of oil reserves, significant reserves of gold, cobalt, diamonds, platinum, 65% of the world's arable land. Mm. So this kind of leads me into another question. So I like how you keep bringing up history, because obviously history is very, very important. So you see this kind of, you know, you see the, obviously the slave trade, and then you see the 19th century scramble for Africa, and then you see the Cold War dynamics in Africa. And today we're starting to see even more geopolitical competition in Africa. How do we avoid, in your role, and your understanding of what we're doing in Africa now, how do we avoid making the same ethical and moral mistakes that we made in the past by not strictly looking at these countries as, you know, how are we going to take advantage of their natural resources and secure, you know, what we need? How do we do it in an ethical way that's mutually beneficial?
You know, that's a great question, right? Because if we had the answer to that question, then the last 50 years of history wouldn't happen, right? Right. You know, I think, honestly, I think things like your podcast are what helped, right? Given humanizing, and I even hate using the word resources because I feel like that takes away the human face. The more we humanize these nations and say, hey, you're not just a resource bed for us, you know, like we have done in the past. These are humans that have needs and have wants and goals, and they have kids and they have families and they just want to live and prosper like anybody else, right? I think that's the number one way. It's just humanize the entire situation and kind of take that resource mindset away from it. I'll give you a really good example though of how this can be done the right way. So I'm down in Botswana last week or 2 weeks ago. And Botswana has a very interesting history. You should 100% read up on it. But essentially, they found gold. I'm sorry, not gold. They found diamonds back in the, I think, my 70s or something like that. Now, what they did was pivotal, right, in their development as a country. They had a great leader at the time. And what he did was he said, hey, we found diamonds. We're going to do this responsibly. And so now, if you look at it, and so what he did with the money was he invested in infrastructure, he invested in education, he invested in development, he invested in all those things. So when you look at the country, you know, 40, 50 years later, all that is in existence, right? How he was able to do that is the more important part, right? He was able to work with, so if you look at the people that are able to mine diamonds in Botswana, there's only one company. One company is called De Beers. De Beers Diamonds, they mine within the country of Botswana. The profits, again, this is just great leadership. The profits are split 50-50, right? So Botswana gets 50% of the profits. De Beers gets 50% of the profits, right, in this mining operation. And really, the Botswanians can almost mine themselves. They just can't refine it. They need the help from De Beers to refine the diamonds or whatever. Outside of that, Botswana also has a 15% stake in the company. They own 15% of the company, right? So now in reality, they're getting 65% of the diamond profits, right? And it's probably not going to go down anytime soon, right? Because diamonds are only increasing in value right now. That is a country who understood the geopolitical dynamics. They had great leadership and they say, we are not going to, and that's the other part, we're not going to let you take advantage of us, right? As much as you may want to, that we are still a sovereign nation and we still have rights. We're not going to allow you to take advantage of us. If you want whatever resource that we have in this country, you're going to have to work with us and we're going to get a piece of it, of whatever it is. So anyways, the answer to your question, Carl, is just, first of all, humanizing the face of these nations, right? Making sure that people understand it's not just a resource bed. These are people who have feelings, who have emotions, who need things just like you need things. Responsibility of nations to make sure they're not taking advantage. But it's also, I think, a big responsibility lies on the African nations themselves within the leadership. Say, hey, look, this is not going to be a repeat of 30 years ago. You're going to work with us or you're not going to work at all.
Right. So what I would hope you could touch on a little bit, kind of, you know, maybe what your expectations were going in and then how the personal experiences and, you know, these conversations, whether it's in a taxi or in a restaurant, have changed your perceptions?
I think the only preconceived notion that I may have had, and this is a preconceived notion that all Americans that have never been to the continent have, this preconceived notion. You for some reason, you imagine the continent of Africa as just being this desolate desert and jungle, right? Mm-hmm. With no sort of modernized technology. I'll admit, I'm guilty of it, right? Before I got here, I knew it wasn't like just some desolate land of nothing. But in my mind, I was like, oh my God, like, are they going to have grocery stores? Like, I am guilty of that. But U.S. media, American media just does a horrible job. And I will say this, I will say this as Major Millage. I don't even care what comes from it. I think the U.S. does a horrible job at painting and making a picture for people what these 54 countries are really like, because it is nothing like Absolutely nothing like. I think that's what we could do better. You know what? You asked the question a couple questions ago. What can we do better as a government as we start to get – why? You know, I said Africa is one of the most important places and it will be for the next 10 years. And you said, well, what we can do? What can we do better? That. Hollywood needs to do something about making sure that we are portraying these African nations. First of all, making sure that we're portraying Africa as 54 countries.
So looking at the future of U.S. military cooperation in Africa, how do you envision the U.S. role in fostering regional security architectures that are led and sustained by African nations? So are we leading towards, I don't want to, again, wording really matters, and please correct me if I use any incorrect terminology. Are we leading towards more of a, I don't want to say a drawback of the U.S. presence, but are we leading towards more allowing African nations to have agency and develop these regional security architectures? Or are we kind of working towards having that, but also maintaining a permanent presence?
Yeah, no, Carl, that's a fantastic question. And honestly, that gives me an opportunity to kind of, you know, I will correct the terminology a little bit just because I love you. And I want to make sure you're successful. When you say permanent presence, that's not how we exist on the continent, right? There are operations within U.S. embassies, right? And so you have the military personnel like myself that work inside the Security Cooperation Office. And then you have the, which I haven't even talked about, the Defense Attaché Office, which if you guys want to have a conversation about that later, we can as well. There are also U.S. military personnel that work within the embassy. And then you have the Marine Security Guard Force that also works within the embassy. But it's not as a military operation, right? We work, for all intents and purposes, we work for the Department of State. My boss is the U.S. ambassador to Senegal, right? That's my boss. That's who I answer to. So we are not, it is not some sort of permanent present military operation. We work for the Department of State. Now, with that being said, there are other, you know, there may be some military to military, we call it mill-to-mill, military-military engagements between U.S. military personnel, kind of like the exercises that I was talking about earlier, you know, those military-military engagements where we have some, you know, military U.S. forces that will come down and train or do exercises with some other African nation militaries and things like that. But that is about as permanent as it is right now. I wouldn't even call that permanent. It's more episodic in a sense. But to, you know, to answer your question, because you really asked a very, very good question, and I want to make sure listeners understand the way you asked that question, because it's very, very, in a very educated way. So I applaud you for that. I think the biggest goal that we have, or at least, and again, I'm not an expert on this, right? But something that I'm going to carry forward to my next job is empowerment. Right. I think empowerment and cooperation is the name of the game. Are we helping to facilitate some sort of regional security infrastructure? I don't know. And quite frankly, I think the answer is no. But in reality, I don't know the answer to that question. But I don't know if that's the goal either. Right. I think the goal is empowerment. The goal is, can we get these African nations, can we get their militaries to a point where they can be sustainable on their own? I think that's the goal. Because, you know, and this goes back to a couple questions ago when Claire asked me how people can help out, what can they do? And I talked about understanding what it is that the partner wants. I don't think there's a partner that's interested in having a permanent U.S. military presence. I could be wrong about that, right? But I don't know if that's their goal either. I think their goal is to be sustainable in what it is they want, sustainable in some sort of security platform, and to be able to execute that. As far as on a continental or regional basis, I think the African Union is trying to mobilize that. And I think that's kind of built into those economic regions, ECOWAS and things like that. I think there's a kind of a security structure already built in to those regional organizations on the continent. So, we're here to help bolster that. We're here to help support that. And we're here to give them the tools and resources that they need to be successful in that, with the end goal being to empower, right? And to empower these militaries to do what it is they need to do. And, you know, and I say that to say, I'm sorry, and I say that, and people's minds might jump to this idea that, well, maybe they're not, are they not already capable? And that's not true, right? Mm-hmm. They're, if you consider, the lack of resources that some of these militaries have, their capabilities far surpasses that of a lot of places, right? Because without the resources, they're doing high level strategic missions that most people wouldn't be able to do if they trained their whole life for. So I think that is something to congratulate them for, and really think about as you move forward from a security standpoint. But again, fantastic question. I really love the way you asked that, because again, I think that people don't think of it that way. But again, like I said in the beginning, our goal here is not to come in with an iron fist and change the way people do things. It's to advise, right? We're really here to advise, and whether you take the advice is up to you. But we're here to advise.
Right. Well, thank you for that. And thank you for correcting my vocabulary or word choice. That's always appreciated. And I think that, you know, probably help some of the listeners. So you mentioned in one of your previous answers to one of our many, many questions about the defense attaché position. So are there any other DOD departments that work inside embassies besides the Security Cooperation Office?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Carl. This just goes further into what people don't know about U.S. embassies even, right? So there, yes, there's a Security Cooperation Office, which military personnel work inside. So first of all, the Department of Defense is just massive, right? There are a lot of different agencies that work for the Department of Defense. You have the DSCA, which is the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, which is what heads up that Security Cooperation Office, right? You have FPD, which is the Force Protection Directorate detachment that kind of works with making sure if there are U.S. military forces in the country that they're safe. They work outside of inside the embassy as well. You have DITRA. DITRA stands for Defense Threat Reduction Agency. It's also a DOD agency. They deal with chemical, biological, radiation, and nuclear threats and concerns. So there's actually a DITRA office within the Security Cooperation here in Senegal, dealing mainly with biological things. You have DHAP, which is also a DOD agency, which is the Defense HIV Awareness Program or something. I forget what the exact what it exactly stands for, but anyways, you have DHAP. And then you also have the Defense Attaché Service. And so there's a position within most U.S. embassies. It's called the SDODAT, the Senior Defense Official Defense Attaché. Essentially, think of them as the Defense Attaché, the SDODAT, is the ambassador's right-hand advisor when it comes to military operations within that country. And when I say military operations, I mean inner military operations. So I'm talking about like that country's military situations or operations that are going on. He advises him, the SDODAT will advise the ambassador on other things like you talked about earlier. What can we be doing as a U.S. military to help on a nation-to-nation basis? That is something that the SDODAT will be advising the ambassador about. Any other security concerns that may exist, things like that. That is something that the SDODAT will advise the ambassador on. The SDODAT is also dual-hatted too. Not only are they advising the ambassador, they're also advising the Pentagon, right? They're also reaching back to the policymakers of the Pentagon saying, hey, this is the state of affairs in this country, right? And this is what I think, this is based off my expertise in the region and in this country, this is what I think you should do based off that. So that's the SDODAT. Yeah, so yeah, there are many DOD agencies that work within the embassy as a whole. But again, like I said earlier, we all work for the Department of State. Our boss is that U.S. ambassador that works inside that country. Actually, funny story. There's a reason why the SDODAT is called the SDODAT, right? The defense official, the senior defense official. There used to be issues in the past of military personnel not understanding who their boss was in the country. And so the SDO, the senior defense official, is the senior U.S. defense official in that country, right? So I don't care if I'm a lieutenant colonel, right? If I'm an 05 lieutenant colonel and I'm the SDODAT in Burundi, I am the senior defense official in that country. If some general walks in, he still has to answer to me, right? I am the senior defense official in that country. I say what goes and I say what doesn't. Now, obviously, with the utmost respect and candor, but that is the reason why that position exists. Lastly is the the Marine Security Detachment, which there sometimes people have a misunderstanding of what the Marines do within the embassy. The Marines are involved with physical security and personnel security of the embassy. They're not, the Marines are not I think movies sometimes mess this up. Like, we're not deploying the Marines at the embassy into the country. That's not how that works, right? We can't do that. That's illegal, as a matter of fact. the U.S. Marines that operate within the U.S. embassy are in charge of physical and personnel security of the people within the embassy. And another important note to understand is that as the U.S. puts embassies in other countries, we actually task the country with the security of the perimeter of the embassy, right? So we have a Senegalese security company that patrols the outside perimeter of the embassy, and then the Marines patrol the inside portion of the embassy is kind of how that works out. So anyways, I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot there. Another thing that we haven't gotten to quite yet is actually the topic of climate change. So what I wanted to ask was, since climate change, of course, will pose significant challenges to security and development, not just in Africa, but yeah, in Africa, what role can the U.S. military play in supporting African nations to mitigate and adapt to environmental threats?
Yeah, that's a great question, Claire. You know, I think it's no secret that when you start talking about climate change and you start talking about the negative effects of climate change, I think the people who are disadvantaged are at the biggest risk, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of poverty on the continent, unfortunately, and so I think the people within this continent are at the greatest risk, and you already see it happening, right? You see food security situations because farms are burning up because they're too hot, right? They're not growing crops. You see water insecurity issues or security issues because, you know, river streams that once existed or basins that once existed or aquifers that once existed are drying up because it's so mm-hmm. darn hot, abnormally hot, right? Hence the climate change portion of that. So I think that it's important to highlight that. And I'm glad you asked that question, Claire, because I think it does affect people within the countries on this continent more than it would anywhere else, right? As access. To answer your question, it is important for us. And I think it's what we're doing a great job at. It's just education, right? Mm-hmm. It's just educating people on what climate change is, because you have to understand that if you ask somebody, if you say, hey, look, that car that you drive to work every day is going to kill the environment. You need to stop driving. Cool. Great. That's a great rich person thing to say.
Yeah.
On the other hand is this person is like, this is the only car I have. Mm-hmm. I have three kids and a wife. And I have to do everything I can to provide for my family. And this is the only way I know how to do it. People need to be able to balance that. And so I think education is key in first understanding that below the equator, it's hot, right? And I think I was reading something the other day, Namibia, Windhoek, which is a beautiful country, by the way. They have like the highest solar index in the world, right? Mm. Botswana too is one of the higher ones. So just imagine, right, if these countries with these really, really high solar indexes could figure out how to harness the power from the sun. If these countries could figure out how to harness the power of the sun, truly, they could take over, really. I mean, there's a lot of technology that exists out there, but really, I think knowledge is where it starts. It's just educating people.
You know, knowing you and, you know, listening to you, and I'm sure Claire and the listeners share this view, but it's always refreshing to hear that people with good intentions. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that we don't hear enough of, despite a lot of people existing with good intentions. And the fact that you kept returning to in almost all your answers, empowerment and cooperation, not something you're coming in and telling people what to do, but you want to cooperate and give whoever you're working with what they need. And, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that you will excel and exceed expectations in your new role. And without getting too sentimental here, I'm very lucky to call you a friend and a mentor. And we really appreciate you coming on and sharing such valuable information with us. Any final thoughts?
I think that the fact, it gives me hope knowing that there are people, there are young people like you in the world who care about not just the U.S., right? But just to care about global things is just something a lot of people don't take interest in. And I think it's so important. So I applaud you One, for this podcast, I think this is a great tool at spreading knowledge. So really congratulations on that. I know you guys talked about it last year, and to see it come into fruition is really exciting. And, you know, congratulations on that. You guys should really, you deserve applause for that. And you should really be proud of the work that you're doing. So that's number one. Number two is I'm, you know, very, very happy to be a part of the show. You know, I've had a good time. And to the listeners, right? This is for the listeners, right? If you truly want to do good in the world, and I think most people do, just be humble, right? Just be humble. I think being humble is something that we've just gotten away from as a society. Just be humble. I promise you, if you just be humble, you're 50% of the way there. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's my advice for the listeners.